Subsequent to this recording, on October 18, 2024, the FDA approved zolbetuximab with fluoropyrimidine and platinum-containing chemotherapy for the first-line treatment of patients with locally advanced, unresectable, or metastatic HER2-negative gastric or gastroesophageal junction adenocarcinoma, whose tumors are claudin 18.2 positive. The approval was based on results from the Phase 3 GLOW and SPOTLIGHT trials, which are among the recently presented data sets in gastrointestinal cancers discussed with Dr. Saab and Dr. Philip in this program. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to the implications of recent data sets and the current and future management of gastrointestinal cancers. We're going to review what happened at the ESMO meeting just recently and also update in general on GI cancers. We have a great faculty day, Dr. Tony Saab from the Mayo Clinic Comprehensive Cancer Center in Mayo Clinic, Arizona and Phoenix, and Dr. Philip from Wayne State University and the Henry Ford Cancer Institute in Detroit. Today, we're going to talk about ESMO and other things that have happened over the last year in GI cancers. As always, we will be talking about the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens. Please check out the package insert for more information. Basically, we asked each of our faculty to come up with a presentation focused on some of these new key data sets, particularly from the ESMO meeting. Philip is going to talk about colorectal cancer, anal cancer, pancreatic cancer, and then Tony, upper GI, HCC, and biliary tract cancer. We're going to slide a little net along the way because there was a cool paper there as well. But we're going to start out in a second. We'll ask Philip to do his presentation. But first, Philip, I want you to get Tony's input on this really fabulous teaching case. I love this case. We could spend the whole hour just on this case. But in brief, Philip, can you summarize for Tony what happened with this 76-year-old man?
Yes, sure. So this is a 76-year-old man who came to see me in 2020, early 2021. And at that point in time, he already had the left hemicolectomy for acute bowel obstruction. And this was an adenocarcinoma mucinous, and it was a PT3N1. When we did his molecular profiling, it showed an MSI high tumor. TMB was 31, and BRAF was mutated, making it not a Lynch syndrome. PDL was 0. We also did his ctDNA and after surgery, and this was cleared. It was 0. And then at that time, I decided to give him adjuvant chemotherapy because of the T4, and he had Capox 4 cycles. However, within a short time, we were following up. His ctDNA was going up, but soon after that, he had increasing abdominal pain, mainly on the left side, rising CEA. And as you can see, he had a tumor growing there, and he also had peritoneal carcinomatosis. And in February of 2022, we started him on immunotherapy using Ipi and Nivo. And he had a quick normalization of his plasma ctDNA. We continued on the treatment. He had arthritis in his hand, grade 2. We put him on steroids, and then we kept him on 5 milligrams. This was a bit early in the course of his treatment, so he was on it for a long time, plus hydroxychloroquine. And then we discussed with him, look, I mean, your ctDNA is now down to normal. It's been down for a long time. Can we stop your treatment? And he said, no, continue until you finish the 2 years. And that's what we did. So he came off treatment in February with the complete response, radiological, and also ctDNA. And he's doing very well now.
So really great case. And one of the things I love about this case, Tony, is, you know, the man presented in 2021, and it's interesting just to see in 3 years how his therapy would be different if he presented today. And Philip has been taking care of him, and he knows, you know, as he looked back on this, he was pointing that out. So first question, Tony, the man had one positive node, MSI high. What are you doing with patients like that nowadays? And also, second question is, well, let's just start with that one. What are you doing right now in the adjuvant setting for MSI high? And also, well, as long as it's on the screen, we can talk about first-line therapy for this man. But yeah. How would you handle his previous situation, so to speak?
So, you know, the there is no prospective data on the role of chemotherapy or immunotherapy in patients with resected colon cancer. There had been in the past a meta-analysis taking a lot of subgroups from patients who went on the larger adjuvant studies, suggesting that there may still be a role for CAPOX. And I would say CAPOX because fluoropyrimidine does not have much activity on its own in MSI-high patients. So if you pick adjuvant, you go with adjuvant CAPOX. I would argue, though, that today you have to sit down with the patient and have a discussion. Do we need to give any treatment, any chemotherapy, period, knowing that if the patient recurs, like he did here, we can salvage incredibly well with immune therapy. So today, waiting atomic data, I don't think you are well justified to use immune therapy in the adjuvant setting. That said, the discussion about chemotherapy is more complex. And I have many patients right now who just opt for observation only pending close observation.
So before I ask you about the second part of his case, Philip Hassan in the chat room has a 35-year-old patient with 3 positive nodes, MSI high.
Any thoughts? How old is the patient?
35.
Very young, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, at that age and the setting, I would still go for chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. When I say unfortunately, it's because, believe it or not, immunotherapy alone can also be a good thing for an older patient. And I had that situation also in a patient who was over 75 or 80. But in a 35-year-old, I would still stick to the experimental arm of atomic and use the chemotherapy like FOLFOX or Zolox plus an immunotherapy drug, immune checkpoint inhibitor. And I really would not, for a 35-year-old, I don't want to wait until the results of the study to be available. I mean, this is a 35-year-old. I would go for what I think is going to be positive. The only question here is, obviously, do we need the chemotherapy? But I'm ignoring that question. I'm just saying I'd give chemotherapy plus immunotherapy.
I can challenge that, though. I would challenge that,
though. Well, hold on. Yeah. Because I was just saying before we get started, I could just let the two of them talk for an hour. I could come back in an hour. I'm sure it'd be great. But let's make sure we get through all this stuff, Tony. So let's keep going here. I want to ask you about the second part here, MSI high relapse. Also, maybe comment on using ctDNA to follow a patient like this. And, of course, the choice of ipi-nivo. Any thoughts, Tony?
Yeah, so I think, you know, MRD assessments, ctDNA assessment, is very reasonable. It cannot be the standard, but I think case by case basis, you can certainly do it. In this case, it made sense. It may pick up something a little bit earlier than otherwise scanning would, although that intensifies the follow-up. So I think it's reasonable. In terms of, you know, the immune therapy, the choice of immune therapy, so two thoughts about this. One, this is really, this case just tells you why it's too premature to consider immune therapy as adjuvant, because you can salvage the few patients that are going to progress and put them into cure mode. That's why I think we need to wait. But the second is, IO makes sense. The question is whether ipi-nivo is or has any advantage over pembro. At this point of time, there's no such evidence. We're still waiting on the ipi-nivo, the nivo arm from the ipi-nivo versus nivo. We can talk about a lot of limitations of the study. I can just go for another hour on it. But pembrolizumab would have been my choice. But I would say this is also a very reasonable choice, pending more data. It's more toxic, more costly, but we don't know if it's more effective.
So another thing I want to ask you about, and then we'll let Philip start with his slides. So I guess because the patient wanted it, is the patient's getting prednisone and an IO, Tony. How does that strike you?
So, you know, there is some controversy on the use of prednisone. Of course, you know, this is immune therapy and prednisone can be immune suppressing agent. But, you know, the 5 milligram dose is I think, a minimalist dose and brings me less concerns. I think going for 2 years is reasonable. I'm sure Philip and I, you know, have had many cases where after 6 to 9 months of treatment, and you had to drop off before of toxicity, and the patients had the same outcome. So you question the 2 years, But 2 years is where the study looked as the maximum limit for patients to receive treatment. So I think this patient, you know, just followed the standard.
So interestingly, before you get to your talk, Phil, a venue has an 87-year-old woman from the chat room, stage 3B colon, status post adjuvant capecitabine for 5 months. ctDNA was negative. Now the patient has lung mets. I assume they were biopsied, but she says the Signatera continues to be negative. Just kind of curious, any difference in sensitivity to cell-free DNA, Tony, based on location of the mets?
Yes. So in my experience, it's been less predictive with lung mets versus liver mets. With liver mets, you know, it's the predictive value is pretty high. But with the lung mets, I've actually had one of every two patients where I haven't been able to follow through with MRD. So I believe that's the discrepancy between two. I think you shed less DNA with lung metastases than with the liver metastases, and then maybe the explanation. Turnover is different. Turnover, cancers metastasizing to the lungs tend to be better prognostic, grow very slowly because of the immune milieu is very different in the lungs versus the liver, and that may explain the difference.
Really interesting. I see Philip was shaking his head the whole time you were talking. But anyhow, Philip, let's keep going here. We got your slides. Speaking of cell-free DNA and ESMO, really interesting paper here.
So this is the Circulate Japan, the Galaxy part of the of their program, which is, you see on the right side. So this was a prospective observational study, and then they looked at regular time points. And this was using the tumor-informed MRD assay. So there are two types of MRD assays. This was a tumor-informed. And the median follow-up time was 23 months. Most patients had T3 or T4 tumors. And just close to the half of the patients had a lymph node positive disease. And just under 50% of the patients received adjuvant chemotherapy. And the take-home message with this is that MRD positivity was significantly associated with worse outcome. When they looked at 24 months and 36 months, both with the OS and the disease-free survival. And if you have clearance, by the way, we don't say negativity, we call it clearance. If you have ctDNA clearance after surgery and the adjuvant treatment or before adjuvant treatment when they didn't have adjuvant therapy, this really associates very well with this better DFS and OS. Of note, just under 10% of the patients who were MRD negative developed a recurrence, molecular recurrence, and most of the recurrences were within the first 18 months after surgery. So this gives you an idea of where you can place MRD in terms of managing patients. But still, there is more to be learned about this, but something which we can discuss if people want to. And then the other paper, which is related to their Galaxy, Circulate Galaxy, was looking at the benefit of, is there benefit of adjuvant chemotherapy in terms of survival in patients who have detected MRD? And the ctDNA positivity, again, they conclude as within the MRD window, which is, remember, it's 2 to 10 weeks after surgery, was associated with significantly inferior disease-free survival or overall survival. So detecting minimal residual disease was not a good thing. But they also showed that there is potential benefit for adjuvant therapy in patients who have developed or have MRD detected. However, the adjuvant treatment did not help the patients who had MRD cleared, the subgroup that had that. So again, this is really giving you an idea of the possibility of using MRD to decide on adjuvant therapy. And this can be discussed further, especially in patients who are like borderline, you want to give chemo or not, especially in patients who are older, and in patients who come to you and say, I don't want any chemotherapy, and you try to really discuss with them how to direct them in terms of making a decision. This is a very interesting trial, which you probably heard many times we will talk about. This is a NICHE-2 study, which came from the Netherlands. Chalabi et al. Had presented this before, and it's already published. This is looking at immunotherapy neoadjuvant in locally advanced MMR deficient colon cancer. So they here they're updating on a 3-year disease-free survival, and the short answer is 3 years, 100% still have disease-free survival. So these are patients who are receiving one cycle of the combination and then another dose of the nivolumab, and then they go to surgery, and that's all they're getting. And almost 100% have a pathological response, and 68% have pathological complete response. So really very impressive. And the question is, why giving it before surgery, you're going to get such a good response? It's probably better than the adjuvant, although we don't have the adjuvant data of single-agent immunotherapy. And then they looked into the ctDNA, back to ctDNA clearance and positivity. And you can see there's a nice correlation between patients who had the treatment initially after one cycle. They had 42% cleared it, and there was further clearance before surgery because they got the other dose. And at the point when there was no recurrence, none of them had any ctDNA detection. So this is another study, which is the niche 3 now, and this is using nivolumab combined with another immune checkpoint inhibitor, which is anti-LAG-3 inhibitor. This is ratlimab, if I can pronounce it correctly. So this is a study, again, which was neoadjuvant, and you can see on the left side, the majority of the patients had locally advanced disease, T4 lesions, and also the lymph node positivity was 2/3 of the patients. And they got the treatment, again, two cycles before surgery, and then they went ahead with surgery. And what did we find? Well, actually, you see here also a major response, a major pathological response, and also a complete pathological response of 68%. It's very similar to the NH2. Again, this is a very interesting trial. I think that they had more grade 3-4 toxicities than the ipi/nivo. So it's like in the region of 10%. So another option for those patients. I can't tell you which one will be the better one because obviously this is not head-to-head and that may never happen. Now, there's another study which is looking at the total neoadjuvant treatment, which has now become a kind of a standard in the treatment of locally advanced rectal cancer. And this was in patients who had proficient MMR. And this was an early first results of the no-cut trial. So no-cut trial is interesting. No-cut, I guess they mean that there's no cutting of the rectum because it's intended to be saving the rectum. So 180 patients. Most tumors with mid or lower, you know, that's where our problem is because we don't like to do operation on those patients because many of them can end up with a colostomy or, and this is the, most patients had stage 3 disease. And this was a study of Capox and also long course radiation therapy. And then they go to surgery. And you can see that the disease-free survival at 30 months was 97%. That's a great number. If you see some secondary analyses, on the top right corner, you can see the ctDNA. If the ctDNA you clear very well, you obviously have a better response to treatment. And if you look at the ctDNA and the outcome of the treatment, again, it separates very well in the two curves with a hazard ratio of over 3. And then you see that if the patients have a recurrence, and by the way, we don't call it recurrence, we call it a regrowth because it's there, it's regrowing. There's a plateau which comes after, I think, around 18 months. So certainly something which is to keep in mind. And in fact, we're doing it. And in fact, in the United States, there's a study called the Janus trial, which is now looking into the triplet for FOLFIRINOX versus FOLFOX in a setting of trying to see if we can, how well can we preserve the rectum and not ending up with a surgical resection. This is the well-known checkpoint 8HW. So this is nivo-ipi versus chemotherapy. This is first-line treatment, so somehow goes into the patient who we discussed earlier. And this is in patients with obviously metastatic disease. They wanted to look at subgroup efficacy and also expanded safety analysis from this originally already known trial. And these are the curves. And you can see that all the subgroups, age above, below 70 or age less than 50, everyone is really doing much better than chemotherapy itself. And then if you look at the other aspects of it, like the KRAS status, the liver metastases, no liver metastases, BRAF, again, you can see that there is superiority. Now, the case that was mentioned about a question about the lung metastases, there is suggestion actually in lung metastases, you can get even better responses in patients who undergo immunotherapy because what Dr. Saab mentioned, the milieu, the immune milieu is different. It's more conducive to response to immunotherapy.
So before we go on, I'll let you conclude your talk. Tony, a couple quick questions from the chat room and for me also. Any trials or role you see in the future of immunotherapy in colon cancer that's resectable? And, you know, just before surgery? And second question is, can you summarize your use of cell-free DNA in the adjuvant and metastatic setting?
No, excellent question. So for the first, you know, as Philip mentioned, I mean, you get some fantastic responses, not surprisingly, with MSI-high, specifically patients with colon cancer. But unlike rectal cancer, say pancreas cancer or gastroesophageal cancers, colon surgeries tend to be less morbid and, in fact, can clear the problem without much complications. So the question, of course, is it really valuable to have neoadjuvant immune therapy? So either you have neoadjuvant immune therapy and you don't go to surgery, or you have surgery, and if that disease comes back, you can treat with immune therapy. The only question that is reasonable to ask is IO versus surgery. I don't think that's a feasible study. And again, given the low morbidity of colon surgeries, you know, that may never happen per se. Now, in rectum, we know we have that data. You essentially, with MSI high, you cure patients with IO-based therapy, no need for chemo, radiation, or surgery. And we know that that's incredibly morbid surgery. We have some data with pancreas with the same. So I think the short answer at this point of time, the standard remains the same. Colon cancer patients go to surgery. For the cell-free DNA question, so yes, I'm using MRD, and I'd say that I'm using it. It's still requiring us sitting down, having a quite a bit of discussion with the patient. What do you do with it? Do you act in terms of if it's positive, do you take the patient the road of chemotherapy? Do you observe more extensively? If it's negative, do you just feel comfortable and take a step back and say, I'm not going to treat you? We don't have that data today. So I use it sitting with a patient, explaining to them that it may create anxieties on both sides, physician and patient side. But, you know, it actually is a very useful tool for many patients where you're, you know, on the border of treatment or no treatment. It may help with the decision-making process. So I'm using it pretty consistently. At least the discussion is pretty consistent. And based on the discussion, we're doing it in more and more patients. For the oligometastatic diseases, what I'm finding it actually very useful, because those, say, liver metastases, they tend to come back in the liver, and they're usually addressable with local regional therapies without even the need of chemotherapy. So I find that tool incredibly useful, and it's very predictive and can lead to shortening sometimes the follow-up scans and depicting those tumors earlier in the stage. I've done it also in peritoneal oligometastatic disease with some decent results. So I'm right now today, I'm finding it most useful in the oligomet disease and pending more data, you know, coming our way from the prospective studies may become, and I suspect from the consistency of the data we're seeing, I suspect, you know, this is going to be a significant guide for adjuvant treatment and colon in the near future.
All right, Philip, let's go back to your talk. And almost every solid tumor program we do nowadays at some point gets into HER2. How about
exactly,
colorectal exactly, cancer?
Exactly right. And HER2, in colon cancer, HER2 is less than 5% of the patients. So one has to keep that in mind, different than gastroesophageal or breast. So DESTINY-CRC01, DESTINY-CRC02, So Destiny CRC01 was a study that had three cohorts, and you can see the cohorts include the typical ones we treat, IHC 3+ or IHC 2+ with FISH positivity. And the cohort B IHC was 2+ and the FISH negative, and then you have the HER2 IHC +1. CRC02 went into stage 1 and stage 2 trying to see what is the optimal dose, and I think that you can see that the 5.4 milligram per kg is the one that really is more optimal. Now, if you go to the findings, as you would probably expect, the response rate in patients who had the 3+ or the 2+ with FISH positivity was certainly more than what you've seen in the other two cohorts. Now, this is what you would say this is expected, but also in terms of the response, maybe I would have expected something to happen also in the lower expressors, but that didn't happen. And then when you look at the response rate in patients who had the 5.4 versus the 6.4, and you can see that the 5.4 was the optimal one, and the response rate is even better than the ones who had higher dose. So 5.4 is the dose that we use nowadays in this situation. So sotorasib and panitumumab, this is the CodeBreaK 300 phase 3 trial. This was looking at the combination of sotorasib 960 or 240 each dose, each one with the combination with panitumumab versus investigator's choice of either regorafenib or triflunitrazol. And if you look at the survival curves, you can see that there is improvement, obviously, with the sotorasib plus panitumumab with either dose used in the PFS, it's improved. And if you look at the survival is still we don't see a big difference, a significant difference, although there might be some trending here. And this was the secondary endpoint. The primary endpoint was the PFS, and you can see that it was easily met the PFS. Okay, so if you look at the other option we have in G12C mutated tumors, the adagrasib, this was combined with cetuximab in patients with CRC metastatic, and this was a phase 1-2 study, the Crystal 1, and just to show you the response rate, which was 32% based on the BICR, and also per investigator 40%. So, and then there were no complete response, but mainly partial responses, and also patients had a fair percentage of patients had stable disease. If you look at the disease control rate, it's 80%, and the median duration of response was 5.8 months, and median PFS 6.9 months, median OS 15.9 months. So this is a single-arm trial. There was no comparison to a control arm. This is another study, which is another molecule, or the zanzalintinib, which is combined with atezo, and the mechanism of action of this compound is a TKI, which attacks multiple kinases, VEGFR, MET, TAM kinase, etc. And again, inclusion of the MET is interesting because we're thinking back again of the value of the MET inhibition, because it could be a biomarker for resistance. It could be a signaling pathway really for resistance for a number of approaches we have, for example, EGFR and other targeting agents we use. This is the study, which is called Stellar 303, a phase 3 trial of Z plus atezo versus regorafenib in patients who were previously treated. And you can look at the design, which is a 1-to-1 randomization of the combination versus regorafenib, with overall survival being the primary endpoint. So this will be a very interesting trial because you're going back into this concept of trying to tweak the microenvironment by using a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And here, the targets that the zanzalintinib attacks probably are going to be interesting to see whether they can modify the immune response to atezo. This is a study which is not Podium, it's POD1UM. So it's a phase 3 trial, which is an interesting concept because we are we are working on anal squamous cell cancer. You know, the squamous cell tumors can have the tendency to maybe respond better to immunotherapy. And here, in squamous cell cancer of the anal, this was a study in patients who have inoperable or metastatic disease. And this was in patients who did not receive chemotherapy for that setting, combining retifanlimab, which is a PD-1 inhibitor, with carboplatin paclitaxel, which is kind of the standard of care in this situation. And you can see that the PFS and the OS both are showing improvement in this study. There was a significant difference. And this is looking at the response rate, and you can see that the response rate is higher in the combination with the immunotherapy. The duration of response is doubled, and the disease control rate is also better. So this really represents a new standard of care for patients with advanced anal squamous cell cancer. And the side effects are what you would expect in a combination like this. I don't want to go into the details of the side effects. So certainly an interesting study to look for. And there's another study which is completed in the United States, which is looking into a different space of immunotherapy plus chemotherapy in anal cancer. So it would be interesting to see whether that will also be aligned with, the results will be aligned with this trial, which I think likelier than not they will be.
So, Tony, I want to get your thoughts on this case of a 77-year-old man with pancreatic cancer that Philip has. Patient presented with an umbilical mass, widespread metastatic disease. Interestingly, KRAS wild type, gets gem-nab, ends up on Q2-week gem-nab, and then has a recurrence. And then, Philip, maybe you can talk about what happened next. This kind of came out of nowhere for me to see pemigatinib and pancreatic cancer in the same case. But you pointed out that KRAS wild type is a different type of pancreatic cancer. So what happened?
So KRAS wild type represents 10% of the patients. And for a long time, when I see a patient with the stage 4 disease, I always do the NGS on them. So I had done this in 2021 when I first saw him, and I knew he had RAS wild type, and I knew he had FGFR fusion. So when he had disease progression on gemcitabine paclitaxel, I said, we go to pemigatinib, and for some reason I didn't find it difficult to prescribe the drug to the guy. And I, because of his age and performance status, I went on a lower dose, which is 9 milligram. And then soon after that, he started to run into problems with hyponatremia, which is not that common at this dose, but he had it, and also hyperphosphatemia, which was well manageable. We had to reduce the dose to 4.5. We scanned him, and he's responding, but he's having complications with the hyponatremia. So we said, okay, let's put it every other day. And it worked for a long time until he progressed a year after starting it. And so this was the interesting thing about him. Now he's put on Nalirion 5-FU since a few weeks ago. And so we managed to, by dose reductions of gem nab-paclitaxel, by targeted therapy because he had KRAS wild type, and now we're putting him on Nalirion 5-FU. So we managed to keep him going despite the fact that he had metastatic disease for the past 3 years.
So, Tony, of course, this is particularly relevant for biliary tract cancer. We're going to talk about some data when we get to biliary tract cancer. But just kind of curious if you could comment as you were listening to Philip talk about what happened to this patient on pemigatinib, how that compares to your experience, sort of the daily life with FGFR inhibitors, shall we say.
Yes. So, first of all, very interesting case. And I've had a couple of cases with FGFR2 fusions over the last few years. It's rare, as Philip said. But those patients actually have overall a better prognosis. Their prognosis is better and their biology is better, but they also respond really exquisitely to these FGFR inhibitors like pemigatinib. But, you know, these agents are also tough. I mean, although they're oral agents, they're targeted, they do have toxicities such as in this patient and require, you know, sometimes multiple dose reductions. And those toxicities for most patients are relatively manageable with those reductions, but there's the occasional patient that may have to take in off the drug. But overall, my experience with a couple of patients is very similar. Those patients do extremely well with GFR. You have to look for it. And the key piece here, you know, to the audience is you really need to make sure that when you order next generation sequencing test, that there is an RNA-seq component to it. Otherwise, you're going to miss a lot of the FGFR fusions or NTRK fusions or other fusions.
You know, it's funny, exactly. When you said that, I could hear the audience saying in their mind, RNA, RNA.
Yeah, RNA.
So let's, as you said it, I know everybody was thinking, because we talk about that all the time.
Yeah.
So let's finish out with your remaining slides. Everybody wants to add IO to everything. Here's another slide. Incidentally, we have Abdul in the chat room as an 84-year-old woman with metastatic pancreatic cancer, post-gem NAB, no targets available, CPS of 70%. I'm not going to ask you about that, but let's just keep going here with your slides.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Hopefully you can try an IO.
So what I'm going to show you now is that this is a study, the Sloan Kettering group did an excellent program of looking at deep dive into molecular things that go with DNA repair and immunotherapy. But I just want to, it's a complex study, so I don't want to make it as simple as possible. Focus on the cohorts. You have three cohorts here. One is the core HRD, BRCA, 1, 2, PALB. The second one is other mutations. So all of you, when you do your NGS, you see it like ATM, ATR, things like that. And people don't know what to do with them. They think that they may respond the same as the BRCA 1 and 2. And you can hear people saying, oh, use the same treatment strategy. The third group is only platinum sensitive. They don't have any mutations. So they wanted to really use olaparib in all of these, but also add immunotherapy, because there's also evidence that immunotherapy may work better in patients who have DNA repair abnormalities. So what did they get? So the first thing is that they saw some interesting results with the addition of the immunotherapy, but in the group of patients who really were the core BRCA1, 2, and PALB2, so there was benefit there. But at this point in time, I really recommend that this study should be a reason why you should be supporting the SWOG trial 2100, which is really looking at maintenance olaparib plus minus immunotherapy, which will be pembro in that study. The second point I want to make is that not all HRD mutations are created equal. So basically, outside of the BRCA1 and 2 and PALB2, the chances of a benefit, as you can see, doesn't look as great for the rest of the mutations. And we need a different strategy there rather than thinking only olaparib will be working. In fact, FDA approval does not include the other ones. Fine. I want to finish off with this. Maybe this is my last slide. This is looking at the KRAS G12D inhibitor. So going back to NGS, nowadays you have to do the NGS before starting treatment because when you first see the patient, as a new patient, because not only looking for the wild type and the opportunities there, but KRAS itself has opportunities. There are many drugs that are currently being developed in the treatment of KRAS mutated tumors, and obviously pancreatic cancer is really big on it. So in this trial, which is a new agent, ASP3082, it's a first in class. It's a degrader. It degrades the protein of the KRAS. And this was in a number of tumor types, but the majority were pancreatic. And there was some interesting response rate here, because when I say interesting, you're talking about patients who are heavily pretreated. There's no other good thing to give them, and yet you're seeing some responses. If you see that on the graph on the left, top left, so you are seeing an interesting single agent activity with this drug. It goes, obviously, we have to wait for larger patient numbers, but certainly it's a very interesting early opportunity to see that KRAS inhibitors, but this is not the first one reported KRAS inhibitor working. There are other drugs that haven't reported, but this is the first in class for this kind of drug, and it's relatively well tolerated.
So we weren't going to cover NET here, but it turns out that maybe the most practice-changing trial in GI cancers at ESMO was this one. Looking at cabozantinib, CABINET, what do they show there, Philip?
So a CABINET trial is a very important one because for a number of reasons. And I just want to summarize because I know we're running out of time, for me at least. It included both extra pancreatic NETs and also pancreatic. So you have to keep in mind that when you say extra pancreatic, and all of us are GI oncologists speaking, we forget the lung. It includes the lung, includes the thymus also, although most of them were gastrointestinal. This was cabozantinib, 60 milligram versus placebo. And upon progression, they went to the cabozantinib. They allowed to do that. And most of the patients, as you can see, the primary tumor type, the GI, was from the pancreas. And you see both in the extrapancreatic NET and also in the PNET, you see responses very significant compared to the placebo. So the real important thing here is that you are seeing benefit in patients who can have this as an added treatment option in terms of the sequential treatment. Many of those patients, we are treating them in sequential, and the more we have treatment, the better we do. Similar to colon cancer, we started off with median survival of 6 months. Now we go into over 3-4 years, and the same thing here. But again, this is really important because you have a response rate here. And unfortunately, most of the TKIs we used, and almost all of them we use in this disease, in these diseases, we don't get a good response rate. So certainly, from that perspective, it's a great addition to our armamentarium. But you look at the PFS, and it's a great separation. This is looking at the extrapancreatic. So you see a great separation, not only the pancreatic, which is really working well. It has a hazard ratio of 0.38. That's very, very impressive. And if you look at the pancreatic net PFS, this is, again, 0.23 hazard ratio.
All right. Well, let's move on to Tony's talk. We're going to talk about some papers in gastroesophageal, HCC, and biliary tract. Before we get into the data, Tony has a case here of a patient. I think he put it out there with the idea that maybe zolbetuximab might be available in the near future. And we're going to face situations like this patient who has a claudin expression, but also has a CPS greater than 5. Patient, and most patients would nowadays, getting FOLFOX Nivo. But I guess the question is, what do you do if and when, presumably, zolbetuximab's available? So I want to ask you, Philip, how you're going to think through these sort of double positive situations. And also, if you could just comment on your own take. There was, of course, one of the things we talked about, and we'll talk about a little more here, is the nausea and vomiting with zolbetuximab. There was another presentation at ESMO specifically looking at that. And I'd like your comments on both of those questions. Philip, A, what are you going to do with double positives? And B, for practical purposes, what have you observed? What did you think about this ESMO paper in terms of nausea and vomiting?
So for the double positive, I will at this point in time continue to use FOLFOX nivolumab for two reasons. One is the response rate, the objective response rate you will probably be seeing. And the second one is that with immunotherapy, there is that tail of the curve. There is that biological change in the tumor that happens that gives it a longer control in terms of the disease control. So I'm still unsure of how that would be better with the use of zolbetuximab. So that's my first point. Now, if maybe we can use the triplet, like chemo, nivolumab, and zolbi, but we don't have that data, and that would be another study, and that would be a study that may take some time for us to see results. In terms of the nausea and vomiting, yes, that's a concern. That's another concern. That may add why using FOLFOX and nivolumab would be my first choice. However, there is the same thing that we applied every time, that we need to be proactive in terms of the aggressive nausea and vomiting. A lot of education has to go there. And there is some evidence that is related to the pharmacokinetics and how the infusion is managed. So those are things that we will probably have to do to really go overcome that. But it's not really, I think, impossible. It's something but we have to keep in mind. But to me, back to the question, no, I will use FOLFOX nivolumab at this time in patients who have like a CPS score. Now, low CPS scores or zero, that's a different thing. I would say I will go probably, likelier than not, I'll go to Zolbetuximab, especially people who have zero PD-L1 expression.
So I'll let Tony get started in a second. I just want to point out this really cool paper. I really enjoyed it from Frontiers in Immunology, looking at the 577 trial comparing to other studies in terms of subgroups. Also, just a reminder, I'm just kind of curious, Tony, do you see neoadjuvant IO chemo coming to gastric cancer? We have these intriguing PathCR results with durvalumab. Do you think, people always ask about these cases who don't respond to the chemo in particular. Do you think this is going to play out?
I think it's a bit premature in many sense. And now the thing about this particular study, Matterhorn, which really looked at FLOT plus Durva pre and post-op, and then placebo pre and post-op with FLOT, is it's compounding on the standard of care now, which has shifted to chemotherapy for most patients with no radiation. However, we know now from history that pathologic response rate is not a predictor for improved outcome. It's good to see, but it doesn't really predict that this is going to be a positive study. So at this point of time, I'd say it's a bit premature to say that IO would be used. And the only times I would use it, Neil, is if I have a locally advanced patient, meaning non-resectable, but non-metastatic, I'm adding an IO in the CPS, more than one or more than five, actually, more enthusiastically, because I need a real good response. Other than that, I'm not using IO therapy for resectable patients.
All right, well, let's see if we can cruise through some more of these ESMO data. We've been talking about zolbetuximab, and we saw some data at ESMO from more data from the Spotlight and GLOW trials. Tony, can you go through your slides?
Yes. So when looking at essentially, the first lines will be zolbetuximab plus chemotherapy from two studies, both the GLOW and the Spotlight, you can see pretty clearly that when you do the combined analysis, you continue to see these nice outcomes. Now, you don't see an added response with added zolbetuximab to chemotherapy, but you sure improve on survival and PFS, and that's consistent when you combine the data from the two studies. And you can see that once the curves separate, they remain separated all the way through, and that's really going now into about 4 to 5 years. So you can see that the tail of the curve is looking pretty favorable for zolbetuximab, and that's a good thing. So then I think that data combined continues to tell us that for those Claudin 18.2 positive patients, that these are agents. This is an agent that essentially would improve outcomes. Now, to the point of we all, those at least who worked with zolbetuximab and similar agents, we all see these just very violent episodes of vomiting, significant nausea. In fact, without doing corrective action, those patients just decide not to continue with the treatment. And so there was a good consensus guidance paper, based on a Delphi panel study, which essentially looked at, what do we do to try to prevent this really severe nausea, given that this agent is actually pretty active. And so for the first, and again, I would refer you to this presentation without going through just too much details, but the key piece is one, to be very aggressive with the prophylaxis, to use your most highly emetic aggressive protocol. The second is essentially the infusion rate. The infusion rate matters. And for patients, who actually experience that the nausea alone, you can reduce the infusion 30, 40 minutes and then restart. With vomiting, you have to stop, let the patient just relax, and you can always restart now or restart later, but it has to be slower. And then, there are other modifications, based on that. But just keep in mind that it's, prevent aggressively, then work with the infusion rate to decrease the risk of these nausea and vomiting. issues. So,
Before you continue, I want to refer, first of all, I want to refer the audience to this slide here where you go through a lot of the key issues in frontline management, you know, putting aside Claude, in which you just talked about. What I want to ask you about, Philip, is this ODAC thing that just came out in terms of PD-1 and metastatic disease, recommending not to use it when PD-1 expression is less than 1. Any thoughts or comments, Philip?
So basically, the initial recommendation was for all, irrespective of PD-L1, but at this time, obviously, the weight of the information and the evidence is against that. I personally, over the years, I've now come to the conclusion that, yeah, if it's a zero, I wouldn't be using it. So certainly, I buy into it. I agree with it. So I see the reason. The only problem is that sometimes the zero may not be an accurate zero. It could be even, so there is expression, but it's the methodology. But we have to agree that the majority of the patients, vast majority, will not respond well. So I'm okay with it.
I thought it was interesting that they didn't make a recommendation about PD-1 zero to five or one to five, because that's also... Yeah. An area of controversy. We also saw at ESMO an update of the KEYNOTE-811 study, HER2 positive disease, first line IO pembro with trastuzumab chemo. Would you like to continue with the slides, Tony?
Yes. So 811, just superb study, presented by our friend and colleague Yelena Janjigian. Essentially continues to show these superb benefits from adding trastuzumab and pembrolizumab to essentially chemotherapy. Really interesting results. Now, I think one of the things that I want to emphasize is that initially, when it went through accelerated approval process, it didn't exclude patients with PD-L1 less than 1, so CPS less than 1 scoring. But when we look at the data in depth, you can see clearly that if you have CPS score more or equal than 1, those are the patients that actually end up having significant improvement in their PFS and significant improvement in their survival, more than the median of the combined group. When you look at the CPS less than 1, those are the patients that don't benefit. Not only their PFS is about the same, but you know, you can argue that their survival is maybe a little bit worse. Although I'd say, you know, overall it's a wash. So I think this helps quite a bit. So the evidence today suggests that we should use trastuzumab, pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy for patients with HER2 positive disease, as long as CPS score is more or equal than 1. If it's under 1, you're just sticking to trastuzumab, no pembrolizumab, no IO is needed here. So I think that clears the air. Remember, CPS score more or equal than 1 is in about 80%+ of the patients. So most of the patients are going to see the 2. But the few that don't need it should not get it. There was another study, and I'm going to go very quickly on this one because I personally don't understand why we actually need this study. I guess the need is someone is seeing the need. I don't see it. And this is trying to move trastuzumab deruxtecan to the first line, thinking that, you know, let's look at trastuzumab deruxtecan in the same setting where we add 5-FU or chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab. And so it looked at, well, this study is pretty complex, looked at multiple cohorts, essentially. These were not comparative cohorts, and the primary endpoint was the response rate. You see the same trends here, you know, that patients, you know, may appear to do similarly, across all these arms. That doesn't seem, at least historically, when you look at all these results, any preferred combination to move forward with. I think the one thing that this is moving towards is trying to essentially take a KEYNOTE-811 type of regimen with trastuzumab deruxtecan instead of trastuzumab into the first line. My concern, and very briefly, my concern is that one, this is a trastuzumab deruxtecan is more toxic. and can lead to interstitial lung disease early. Two, trastuzumab deruxtecan works really well following trastuzumab, which is great. These are the patients we want to salvage. We don't have data for trastuzumab following trastuzumab deruxtecan. So we lose an option. We bring a more toxic option early on. Now, this study will probably continue to move forward, but unfortunately, in my mind, this will never change our standard given the limitations with trastuzumab deruxtecan. That's so, what an editorial wrote.
Before we finish out with HCC, and I'd say I'm really, like everybody else, we're really looking forward to the first-line metastatic breast study that's looking at TDXD, because I know what the breast people are expecting, and we'll see. Whether, you know, it's always interesting to ask outside of breast, and that's what I was going to go back to Philip very quickly. I love it. But you guys have had more experience than the other non-breast people because of what we're talking about here. Philip, just want to know, what's your current approach to screening for ILD in the patients you treat with TDXD? And what have you seen in your experience in terms of response to TDXD?
Obviously, we're very careful in talking to patients and any symptoms they have. And we're also doing the scans every 2 months for their disease, and we're also including the chest CT scan. So beyond that, being just very careful in terms of any symptoms that might indicate the disease. So that would be, the response rates are around what we have seen. Maybe 1 in 3 of the patients I've treated or so have had a partial response. And the duration of response of the few patients I've treated will be around maybe 6-7 months. Until they progress, yes. So that's been my experience. But I know the range can go different ways, but depending on the type of the patients you treat.
So let's finish out with a few things about HCC. This is a case that Tony has of a 65-year-old man who got the STRIDE regimen of durva-tremi, tolerated very well except for a mild diarrhea, and still on treatment with a near CR, not necessarily typical, but there it is, a patient who had a great response. Tony, you want to talk a little bit about follow-up from the Himalaya study?
Yes, very quickly. So this this study was a study just looking at STRIDE, which is tremelimumab, single dose, plus durvalumab, high-dose tremi, and versus sorafenib, and it was positive. PFS was essentially not improved, but what was improved is the overall survival. And they've had the longest overall survival follow-up, in this case 5 years, which continues to show that even after 5 years, you see about close to 20% of the patients versus 10% in the sorafenib arm that appear to have a survival benefit. So that's certainly a positive to see that 5 years out, again, you know, in HCC, something that we wouldn't have dreamed of, back 10, 20 years ago. So we had another study with Nivo Ipi. So again, just to stay with the IO theme, Checkmate 9DW, which looked at Nivo Ipi versus lenvatinib or sorafenib. Now, this used the higher dose of Ipi and the lower dose of Nivo, which explains later when I show you the toxicities were much worse. Now, when you look at the outcomes, again, PFS at the median was not much different, although it did seem to separate later. But overall, median PFS with these IO-IO combinations doesn't seem to actually be significantly improved. But the OS was improved, and you can see, again, a separation of the curves. This has a lower rate follow-up. It doesn't look much different, by the way, than Himalaya, but the responses are maybe a little bit higher historically, although I think overall within the same range, including with atezo-bev. The one issue with this is that the level of toxicity that you see, and that's probably because of the higher dose of Ipi, and you do see actually about 20% of the patients discontinuing treatment because of treatment-related adverse events, 1 out of 5. So that's quite a bit, frankly. And when you look at the overall data, including outcomes data, you see more toxicity. You don't see any significant, at least historically, improved outcomes versus, say, Himalaya or even Embrave 150, which in my clinic at this point of time, I would not prioritize this over the other two regimens of atezo-bev or STRIDE. And then, you know, another study, interesting study is phase three LEAP 012 study, which, you know, similar in some ways to the, at least the setting where Emerald One was looked at, is looking at TACE patients with and without lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab for this intermediate group of patients. Here, what we see, essentially, we see a PFS improvement, and the hazard ratio was 0.66. At this point, at least, we don't see an overall survival improvement, although it's still trending towards the Lenva-Pembro-TACE arm. We still need more time for this to mature, but the PFS was positive and consistent with what we've seen with the Emerald One. And just a reminder, the Emerald One was essentially looking, it had a three-arm study looking essentially at with TACE, Durva, and then Durva plus TACE, followed by Durva Beva, Durva, Durva placebo, and then placebo, placebo, placebo. And the update at ESMO was essentially looking at the outcomes by baseline tumor burden. What they call these the up to seven criterion, within up to seven and beyond up to seven. You would imagine the beyond up to seven would be worse, you know, larger tumors, more, and so more accounting, more burden to the liver. And what they've seen essentially is that for those patients, and we're talking about PFS, we don't have any OS data at this point. For those patients that were within the up to seven or beyond the up to seven, the both patients groups did benefit from Durva Beva TACE versus the placebo TACE. Though interestingly, in the absence of the bevacizumab added, there was not much of a difference between Durva TACE or placebo TACE. So that's interesting. It seems like you need that VEGF inhibition to get improved outcomes. Survival is not available, and so we're still waiting on survival, although this was the primary endpoint.
You have some really cool slides here at the end for people to check out. I don't think there was much exciting stuff presented at ESMO in terms of biliary tract, but we did talk before about FGFR inhibitions. But you can check out Tony's slides summarizing some of the data in biliary tract cancers in terms of upfront treatment, FGFR, and HER2 as well. But I think we'll bring this to a close. Sorry for running over a couple minutes, but so much stuff to talk about. Thanks so much to Tony and Philip. Thank you all for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Tony. Thanks, Philip.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.